Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitars that I've been playing lately. The S1 has two separate channels. It has one for your guitar and then another one for a microphone. And then there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you could access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch plug. And the S1s are also very easy to carry. It's got an easy to grab top handle and absolutely anyone can tote it around. And it's also rechargeable for up to 11 hours. The S1 was specifically designed to optimize the sound of your acoustic guitar on acoustic guitar gigs. The guitar and mic channels each have separate tone, volume, and reverb controls, and there's also a proprietary tone match switch, which restores and optimizes the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically the biggest problem with acoustic amps. Now, I tested the S1 myself, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls sound great, and they're very responsive. You can position the S1 in four different ways. You can tilt it back so you broadcast out to an audience, or you could put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. And the cool thing is the S1 has a Bose accelerometer, so it automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound for whichever one of these four positions you're using. The S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker that Bose makes, which is pretty compelling since Bose is known for the quality of their Bluetooth speakers. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. And the bottom line is this. If you're an acoustic guitar player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big that's also easy to carry and battery powered. As far as the Bluetooth speaker goes, I've used it many times here at home for family barbecues, and the sound is so good, my kids wind up arguing over who gets to play the music they want. You know, it's literally like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can use the S1 for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend a bunch of money on loads of different speakers and pedals to get the same thing the S1 does on its own. On top of that, it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years for any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. Get the S1. It's outstanding. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's ANNE at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And we are with Rock and Roll Legacy today with Gary Peel from Boston Alliance and Sammy Hagar's band way back. Tremendous guitar player. Before we get started, I just want to remind you that if you're listening to the audio, you can also watch the video live on YouTube now. Let me talk about Gary Peel's background. Moved to San Francisco from Chicago at age 12. At 19, he had his recording debut with a band called Day Blindness in 1969, and then a band called Fox, which opened at the Fillmore which is amazing, for free when they had Paul Rogers. Also opened up on shows with Janis Joplin, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Eric Burdon, and War, and Mose Allison. His first big break came in 1977 when he joined Sammy Hagar's band, where he toured and recorded for 8 years. Gary met Tom Scholz when Sammy was opening for Boston between 77 and 79. In 85, Sammy went to join Van Halen. Gary joined Boston to help finish the third Stage album. In addition to lead guitar, Gary plays acoustic 12-string guitar, keyboards, and he also sings background vocals and harmony. He's been Tom Scholz's right-hand man ever since, for over 20 years, serving as vice president of Scholz Research and Development, assisting in building Tom's Hideaway Studio 2, and he's a crucial part of the massive technical undertaking of managing the stage equipment on a Boston tour, including all the backline and audio equipment, which, with the precision of the sound that you guys deliver, I got to believe is a lot of work. In addition to his work with Boston, Gary's involved in a project band called Alliance. It's drummer Dave Lauser from Sammy Hagar's band, Alan Fitzgerald on keys from Night Ranger, and Robert Berry, who plays bass, vocals, and keyboards and synth on this last record. Robert's from Band 3, which was with Emerson and Palmer, from Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and GTR with Steve Howe. The band plays old school hard and progressive rock. They've released 5 albums and they have a new one coming out really soon called Fire and Grace. I've listened to the record. It is dynamite, man. It was, and I say this in the most positive way, it was like stepping back in a time capsule when rock and roll was loud and progressive and awesome. Robert Berry and Gary are also in a band called December People. They do traditional holiday songs, but in the style of different rock bands, like they do Joy to the World as if The Who is playing it. Santa Claus is Coming to Town, like ZZ Top might play it. And every show they do is a benefit for a local charity, usually a food bank. A longtime vegetarian, Gary resides in the suburb of Boston with his wife and 2 sons. Gary, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate your time, man.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me today.
You got it. What prompted you? You were originally from Chicago, and I think your family relocated to the Bay Area.
Right. My parents got divorced. My dad went to New Jersey. My mom went to California, and I had the choice. Where do you want to go? And I said, well, California.
Wow. That's unusual to get the choice. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So again, I was about 12, but then when I was in my teens, my mother was working at a shopping center there, and she said, gee, there's another woman that works with me in the office. You know, she was an office secretary. And she said, then she just moved back here from New Jersey, and her son plays guitar too, just like you. And I think, yeah. Everybody I know plays guitar. And she said, but he's a little older than you, so he stayed in New Jersey, but blah, blah, blah. So years later, my mom says, oh, well, didn't Adele's son do well? I said, Adele, oh, yeah, the woman that you worked with, in the office. Yeah, that was Adele Springsteen.
Oh, my God, that is hilarious.
Yeah. So I tell this to my dad, and my dad says, well, I work with Jay Giles' father. What are the odds of that?
Very weird, man.
Yeah.
Very strange. So tell the story, if you can, about your guitar teacher in San Francisco. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. So again, just being at the right place at the right time. So I'm in high school in a band, and the other guitarist in the band said, hey, there's this guy giving lessons in the next town over, and he's really good. We should all take lessons from him. So we went to see his band play. They were called the Warlocks, and this guy was great. And so we started taking lessons, but he stopped giving lessons after a while because they changed their name to the Grateful Dead. And that was Jerry Garcia giving us lessons.
Oh my. How long did you take lessons from Jerry for?
Not long. It was only a few months there before, again, they changed their name, got the record deal, and the rest was history. And of course, people ask, like, oh, man, was he stoned, man? I mean, what kind of guy was he? And as you know, sometimes great players are not the best teachers.
Yeah.
But he was a great teacher because he understood how to speak to us, some young teenagers just trying to pick up guitar. And the other thing I noticed in his rehearsal room there was a banjo in the corner. And I'm thinking, well, that's not very rock and roll. Yeah. And so I asked him, I said, is that yours? And he said, oh, absolutely. I love bluegrass. So that really opened my eyes. Like, oh, you don't have to just play one style of music. That you can be open to lots of things.
So he was kind of a, even though you weren't with him a long time, he was a pretty good influence on you.
Yes, absolutely. Again, very professional, down to earth. Okay, here's you know, here's what you need to know. And again, was able to speak to us in a language that we understood.
That's really cool, man. That's I've had interviewed a lot of people who have taken lessons from Satriani when he was in the Bay Area. Never Jerry Garcia. This is like, you know, that's royalty, man. That's rock royalty.
You know, I heard a great story about Randy Rhoads back in the day, that as he was on tour with Ozzy, when they had time, he would go to the local guitar teacher just to learn from that guy. You know, he was always learning. I thought, what a great story.
Yeah. I have had people that have studied with Randy as well on the show, and they all, you know, they're very effusive about he's a, you know, nothing like this, you know, heavy metal rock and roll, very quiet, very nice, really like incredible work ethic to help people, and, you know, just a good human being in general. So how'd you wind up connecting with Sammy Hagar initially? And maybe can you share a funny or interesting story from the time you spent with him?
Sure. Yeah. So I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area and was in a club band there, just, you know, paying our dues, playing all around. We had the two brothers in the band, Mitchell and David Froom. Mitchell went on to be a terrific producer. You know, Paul McCartney, Crowded House, Los Lobos, Sheryl Crow, Bonnie Raitt, Elvis Costello, on and on and on. But we always needed a great singer, and we heard that Sammy had just left Montrose. So somehow we got his number and called him up, and we said, hey, we're looking for a singer for our band. And he said, well, thanks. I'm kind of putting my band together. I'm not looking to join, you know, anybody. I've got a couple of guys I'm working with, but let me do a couple of shows with you. So he actually opened for us as he was, you know, again, putting his band together. So we kept in touch, and our manager told me, he said, look, why don't you join Sammy's band? You know, we couldn't find a singer. Why don't you join his band? I said, well, he's been through like a half a dozen guys. Why should I join his band? You know, just kick me out in a couple of weeks. He said, well, why don't you give him a call and talk to him? So I was talking to him on the phone, and he said, hey, Peel, are you into drugs? I said, well, no, why? He said, well, because the last guitar player I had OD'd on cocaine in the bathroom of a gas station.
I said, holy smokes.
So he said, well, why don't you come down and jam with us? So I go down to the jam / audition. And while I'm there, Sammy's manager calls and says, hey, there was a gig with Queen and Thin Lizzy. Queen canceled. Thin Lizzy's going to headline. You guys could be the opening act if you have a guitar player. Oh, so, of course, he turns to me and says, hey, can you do the gig? It's in 2 days. Oh, yeah, sure. So, of course, I went home and practiced as hard as I could and did the show. And we actually got a nice review for it. But I just figured I was filling in for him. And so at the end of we did two shows. At the end of the second show, I'm saying goodbye to the guys, thinking, well, you know, I hope we see each other again. And Bill Church, the bass player, goes, no, you're in the band. You know, that's it. So I go, oh, nobody really told me. So
wow. That's a common thing.
Yeah.
So, I hear that a lot.
I was, again, lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
What was it like opening for Thin Lizzy? Did you get a chance to interact with those guys?
Not a whole lot. And of course, we thought they were terrific. You know, it was great to see Phil Lynott and the guys back in the day. Yeah, they were great.
Wow. That's amazing how that happened.
Yeah.
Talk about, you know, how you initially connected with Tom and how you wound up joining Boston once Sammy left to join Van Halen.
Yeah. Well, almost one of the first tours we did when I joined Sammy was to open up for the end of Boston's first tour. Our manager knew their manager, and we got on their last couple of weeks worth of shows for that their first tour, which ended up in 77. And they liked us, we liked them, and they said, hey, you guys should open our entire second tour. And that's what we did, 78 through 79. We played everywhere. And of course, Sammy wasn't very well known at the time. You know, we'd go down south to Alabama or something, and they'd say, oh, yeah, Sammy Hagar. He's one of the Hagar twins from Hee Haw, right? Montrose, oh, yeah, okay. That's when we got to know the guys in Boston. And, of course, Tom and I shared electronics geekdom. And so I'd be the guy asking Tom, hey, what's that thing over there? How does this work? How'd you get that sound? What are you doing over here? You know, and he was nice enough to tell me what he was doing. And then he started his own electronics company. And actually, when I was still in Sammy's band, I helped demonstrate some of his products, because they were all electronic products for guitars.
Mm.
I helped demonstrate some of those at the NAMM show. That's the National Association of Music Merchandisers in LA, and it's only open to music store owners and buyers. It's not a public thing.
Sure.
But he needed somebody to demonstrate the stuff and asked me to come down. So I had done that. And then in 85, when Sammy got the call to join Van Halen, Tom called me and said, "Hey, I heard you're out of the gig. Would you come back here and help me finish our third album? We got one more song to be recorded." And at that point, that's all he was offering. Of course, I said, "Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, boss, it's one of my favorite bands. Love to do it." So I left from our last gig with Sammy, which was Farm Aid One in Champaign, Illinois.
Wow.
Flew directly from there to Boston to start working with Tom. After a few weeks, Tom said, "You know, I think we've worked well together. Why don't you move back here? We'll finish the record. Maybe we'll do a tour." It had been 8 years since the last tour, you know. And as Andy Warhol said, you know, you're only allowed 15 minutes of fame.
That's right.
So we had no idea if the third Boston album would be successful. But as it happened, it went to number one.
Yeah.
The song Amanda went to number one. We did a great tour. And then I'll keep going here and say that. So at the end of that tour, Tom came to us and said, "You know, it's going to be a few years between now and the next Boston album. So if anybody has any side projects, now's the time to do it." So I called up my old Sammy Hagar buddies, Alan Fitzgerald, alias Fitz on keys, and he had gone on to play with Night Ranger, but he had some time, and David Lauser, the drummer. And David said, "You know, when Sammy was leaving the band, Geffen Records was trying to put us together with another singer because, you know, we had a great band."
Yeah.
They introduced us to Robert Barry. And so we said, "Well, let's give him a call." So Robert, Fitz, and Dave and I met actually in Sammy's recording studio and jammed through some song ideas. And we just, you know, felt like brothers. I mean, like we'd known them all our life. Robert fit in right with us. And of course, so Dave and Fitz and I had played a lot together. And again, Robert was one of the guys immediately.
You've had some, it seems everything's been really organic for you. Like there was no big gaps or like stressing out. It seems like kind of things moved, you know, flowed really well.
Yeah. How lucky could a guy get, you know,
yeah.
That, you know, and if you would have told me and Sammy a year before, it's like, "Oh, you're going to join Van Halen and you're going to join Boston." We were saying, "What are the odds of that? Come
right.
on."
Right.
But yeah. I wasn't out of work for a day. How lucky could a guy get?
Is there anything you attribute that to?
You know, as I say, being in the right place at the right time.
That's really amazing.
The thought it was, again, there are plenty of guys that are way better musicians than me, you know, that can play a million notes per hour. You know, blah, 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 you know, I'm not that guy, you know. I'd like to think that I'm a team player, that I try to make the song sound as good as possible. And in the studio, both with Sammy and with Tom Scholz in Boston, when we were working on a song, even though it was Sammy's song or Tom's song, they gave us, you know, complete freedom. Like, "Hey, play whatever you want." You know, it wasn't like, "No, you got to play this. You got to play, you know, do it this way." You know, no, it's like, do whatever you want, because they trusted us as, you know, backing band or whatever. And that was always a wonderful thing. And I appreciated that, again, being in club bands, writing songs with, you know, your buddies, that you're all just trying to make the song sound better. And again, that's how it still is in Alliance, that I trust the other guys to know if something's good or not, or let's try this, you know, if it's my song or not, you know. Dave, the drummer, will sometimes tell me, you know, "We'll strum it like this, you know, on this one section." It's like, "Hey, here's the drummer telling me how to play guitar, you know." But no, I trust him completely. So if he says, "Do it like this," I do it, you know.
Yeah.
And 9 out of 10 times, it sounds great. So that's the key to being in a great band.
The other thing that's really unusual is, in your situation, you've had these incredibly long-term relationships in music, which is not the common, not to this extent.
Yeah. Yeah. 8 years with Sammy, you look back on it and it's like, well, you know, of course it just flew by, you know, 8 years, but yeah, that's a long time for bands to be together even. And now 32-33 years or whatever with Boston. Yeah, it's a long time.
And Alliance,
yeah. gosh, it's almost 30 years since we started Alliance, too, yeah.
That's really cool, man.
And, of course, I wish we would have had more time together, but we're old school in that we don't want to just send tracks back and forth like you can do these days.
Yeah.
You email your tracks to one guy, and then he puts his parts on and sends it to the next guy, you know, chain letter kind of thing.
Yeah.
we only write songs and put them together when we were all together in the studio. And like, for instance, this latest album, Fire and Grace, the title track was a guitar riff I had. Dave had a cool drum groove, and Robert said, hey, I got some lyrics that might work with this. We hit the record button, went in the studio, and we wrote that 4-minute song in 4 minutes. Just played it. There it was, you know, wow. Take one, done.
That's awesome. Where did you record this?
In Robert's studio in California.
Very cool. Very cool. For people who haven't heard of Alliance, you talked a little bit about the band. The last record, Gap, is the long gap just because scheduling, getting all your schedules together?
Exactly, yeah. As it turned out, Boston got very busy here in this millennium.
Yeah.
Where we did 2012, then 14, 15, 16, 17. And we haven't worked that hard since the 70s. So it's been quite busy. And then, of course, the other guys, Robert has been with a bunch of people, and Dave plays with Sammy, and of course, on the Wobberitos. And so, yeah, it was really hard getting us all together in the same place at the same time. And to that end, the one thing that we had done over the last, 8-9 years is during the holidays, where people usually, you know, don't go on tour. That's when Robert had the idea, hey, let's do a holiday charity band. And so we call
really
that
cool.
The Summer Bowl, yeah. Where, again, we play traditional holiday songs, but in the styles of all the classic rock bands, you know, Zeppelin and AC/DC and Santana, Huey, and on and on and on. And but they're the traditional songs that everybody grew up with and can sing along with. So it's a family-friendly show. And the audience gets it. And they know the songs, but in those styles. And so they have a great time, and we do too. And again, every show is a benefit for a local charity.
Is this usually out in California you do these?
Yes, right. Although we've done a few in other places around the country, but mostly out there because the other guys all live up there. I live in Boston, but the other guys live out there.
Where do you post when you're going to have that show? Because I think a lot of people listening would probably be interested in that.
Decemberpeople.com.
Decemberpeople.com.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
It is. It's great doing it. Again, the audience just loves it because they get the joke. Yeah.
Very cool. Hey, so let's talk about the new record, Fire and Grace. I'm going to pull up my iTunes here so I can look at it, talk about some of the songs. There was a lot of songs on here I like. I want to talk about two or three of them. First of all, 12 songs, 51 minutes. That's a ton of value, and that's a beefy album, especially nowadays where most people are releasing EPs, understandably so. I was curious, since it was a while, I would imagine you had a lot of stuff to choose from when you sat down together. What was the weeding out process like?
Yeah, you're exactly right. We had like 20 or something songs that we'd written or partially written over the time, over the last 10 years. And we pulled them up at Robert's studio, even if they were just quick demos or whatever we had of the stuff, and listened to them, and we just checked them off, you know, gave them a rating right there. You know, these are the best, and we ended up with those. And as I said, even at that point, again, this is last December, we still had a bunch of ideas that we wanted to record. As I say, like Fire and Grace, we record on the spot, and we had a couple of others that we brought in right there at the time and did them. So yeah, it all got finished there last December.
Very cool. Great record. There's a song called Uncertain. It's a really great, like, kick-ass, you know, rock anthem. Is there any backstory to that song?
That's one of Robert's songs. He's really a prolific songwriter. Dave wrote a couple songs. I wrote a couple. Again, the three of us wrote Fire and Grace together, but the rest were written by Robert. And so, but I got to say, I think almost all the lyrics on this record have a positive message. And we certainly appreciate that. There's so much negativity in the world these days. We try to come up with something positive.
Yeah, I think that's needed, to be honest with you. A lot of it. I'll have some of that, man. That's a really cool grooving rock song. There's some great opening chords on there. I was curious what guitar you were playing on that track. And in fact, what were your main guitars for the whole record?
Yeah, that was one of the songs that I brought in.
Great song.
Actually, I just happen to have that guitar here.
Dude, let's check it out. Absolutely.
This is a guitar built by Bill Foley. If you can see this thing here.
Yeah.
He's got this resonating hole here, and he says that helps it to sustain forever.
That is a cool, is that Foley? Where is he out of?
Ohio. So if you go to BillFoley.com, I'm sure you can find him. But I had met him some years ago when I was working for Tom Scholz at the Rockman factory, because Bill has a music store and they carried some of the Rockman gear. So I'd got to meet him over the years. And he was always a great guitar luthier. And so he was telling me about this, again, invention, whatever you want to call it, that he came up with. And I said, gosh, I got to hear that, you know? And so, yeah, it sounds fantastic. And so this was my go-to guitar. It's just sounds great. What can I say? So I haven't even had a chance to take it on the road yet because, again, I just got it last year. But this was the one.
So Let me describe it for people listening, not watching the video. So it looks kind of like a combination. It looks like a Strat-ish guitar with two humbuckers. It's like a humbucker in the bridge and in the neck. Looks like a P90.
Exactly right. So yeah, it's a P90 there. It happens to be a Seymour Duncan humbucking P90. And then it's a DiMarzio Illuminator in the bridge. And of course, it's got the push-pull, so you can get two different sounds out of that pickup. And then also, this knob here is the EMG preamp. And so you can either have it off or dial in some extra preamp gain.
That's EMG?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I had Rob on the show and we talked about that, actually. Oh, yeah. Yeah, really cool. That's interesting, man. You've got three pickup manufacturers, or he's got three pickup manufacturers involved in it. That's an unusual, that's really weird. Not common, yeah. I should say. Nice neck on that, man. Is that ebony or rosewood? I can't see it.
Just rosewood.
Yeah, it's pretty neck, man.
Yes. But pretty, straightforward, just dot inlays, and his special headstock on there.
Very cool guitar, man.
Yeah. It's a bolt on. But what, again, you never know. I've tried guitars. I'm sure, lots of guitar players have done this. Go to a music store and you're trying out guitars and even the exact same guitar, here's a Les Paul, there's another one just like it, same color.
Yeah.
Sound different, So every guitar is different. So you never know till you plug it in and try it out how it's going to sound. But this is a good one.
Man, your fingers are like the perfect guitar fingers. Good Lord, man. You've got such nice long fingers. Holy smokes, Gary.
Yeah.
Wow.
And my left thumb is double jointed.
Wow. Oh, my God.
I don't know if that helps or not, but.
You look like you could climb trees with those hands. Good Lord. Man. Holy smokes. No wonder why you're such a good guitar player. Wow. The Same, you have a last song called The Same. Really, it's perfect closing track. Nice acoustic opening transition into like a really good rock and roll song. Was it hard to select the order? Because that's always like art and science together.
Yeah. Again, that was one of the things that the three of us sat down with and kind of went through it. And, what key is this song in? And again, tempo and vibe and all that kind of stuff. And so, a little bit of weeding around, change this, change that, and that seemed to work for us.
When you do that, when you're at the song selection part, is that like sort of the fun, not the fun because it's all fun, but from an accomplishment standpoint, it's like that's got to be one of the last things you do. Exactly. That's got to be a good feeling.
Right, yeah. At that point, the songs are recorded, they're done. And now it's just like, okay, what order do we want them in? What flows best to us? And so, we'll make a CD and put it in our car and drive around and just listen to it, see how things flow and, that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's the easy part.
I wanted to ask you a question earlier, and you mentioned the Rockman. To the extent you can discuss it, what does Scholz Research R&D do? Because, I've heard of Tom, that company throughout the years, but the perception is it's hush hush,
but whatever is going on there, Tom's brilliant. So it's good stuff. Like, is it nuclear warheads? I don't know. But, you know, what if, to the extent you can share it, what does the company do? What does Schultz R&D do?
Well, the company is gone now.
Oh, okay.
But back again in the 70s, Tom was using Marshall amps without a master volume. They didn't make master volume amps back then, right? Hmm. You know? So the amps were really loud, and he said, you know, I wish there was some way that we could turn down the amp, still get the great sound, but just turn it down so it's not blasting into the microphones. That was the big key, you know, for playing live. Hmm. It's fine if you're in the studio, you know, crank it up, do whatever you want, you know. But when you're on stage and your microphone is right there, you know, it's like 10, 20 feet away, your amp is too loud compared to your voice. And so he came up with the idea of the power soak. That was his first invention. Just a resistive load. And of course, these days, there are a whole bunch of them. You know? But again, he was one of the first guys to do this. So that went between the amp and the speaker cabinet. And so it just reduced the voltage from the amp to the speaker. So that you can turn your amp on 11, wherever you want it to, but then turn down the power soak to get whatever volume you want on stage.
Okay.
So that was his first product, and of course that sold well. And then he had this other idea, and I'm not sure where he got the idea, but he made something called the Rockman, which is a headphone amp about the size of a Walkman from those days, you know, yeah. Cassette player. But you plug your guitar into it and use headphones. And so now you don't have to, there's no sound external. So my dad would have paid a lot for one of those. So to put the headphones on and play, you know, all night long.
Right, right.
But the key to that was it had terrific sounds in it. Instead of just like a bzz, bzz, you know, fuzz tone kind of sound and a clean sound, he had a compressor built in and all kinds of filters and stuff that was made incorrectly but sounded great. You know, people would look at the circuitry and say, well, that's not the right way to use a FET transistor. And Tom would say, no, but it sounds great. You know? So that was, again, his genius of figuring out how to get that, you know, big amp sound in this little bitty box. And it was so amazing. I remember the first time I heard one at a music store, you know, I plugged in and put the headphones on. I go, oh my God, it's got reverb and echo and chorus in this little box. It was just like unbelievable at the time. And of course, they sold very well. And in fact, they used to say everybody from Alabama to ZZ Top, from A to Z, have used those for recording records. You know, Jeff Beck talked about how he used it, and Paul McCartney. It goes on and on and on about people have used a Rockman to record with.
Very cool. And then he just shut the company, or the company got sold, or he just shut it down?
He sold it to Dunlop. And still make some of the products, yeah.
Very cool.
But all those amps that he designed, we still use those today on stage. So in the back, there's serial numbers and dates, you know, 1987, you know, those are the amps.
That's really cool though. Yeah.
And to that end, you had mentioned that I'm helpful in putting together the crew and the sound and all that kind of stuff. It's because when we first went on tour with these things in 87, our crew had no idea what these things were. And they don't look like regular amps. It's not like knobs, you know, volume, treble, middle, bass. There's switches and sliders and stuff. And the thing's only this big. And our crew was like, what's that? You know, they had no idea. So only Tom and I knew how the stuff worked. And so we'd have to teach them, okay, this is this. And I remember that our first tour with this gear was my first tour with the band. And we were assembling all the gear and trying to, you know, get those same sounds from the first two records, you know, to happen with this new stuff. And we spent months with the band, you know, breaking in some new guys, you know, because it was just Tom and Brad, the original guys, and then me and some other guys joining that tour. And so we were practicing and trying to get all the sounds, and we would play a couple songs and then stop and tweak things, and then play a couple more and then stop and tweak some more things. And we never got to play the entire set all the way through. And we had had, again, the album went to number one. So we said, wow, we can do some big shows. So one of our biggest, right away, the first part of the tour was the Texas Jam, you know, 80,000 people.
Yeah,
in the
Cotton. I remember that.
So we said, well, we better have some warm-up dates, you know, before that. So we had four shows lined up to do before the Texas Jam. But the gear wasn't ready. You know, we weren't ready. we canceled the first three shows. And that was like one more show before the Texas Jam was Rochester, New York. And I'll never forget that, you know. But we get there and we still had never played the songs all the way through the set. You know, we'd always have to stop and change things, whatever. But just before we go on stage, you know, Tom takes us to the side and gives us the pep talk and says, okay, guys, we're going to go out there and play. And no matter what happens, we'll just keep playing. You know, let's go rock and roll. And we run on the stage and everything worked great.
Oh, cool.
And I, yeah, you know, I'll tell you, I got choked up. I looked at, over my crew guy over there, the guitar tech, and we're going, oh man, it works.
That's so awesome.
It was a great night.
And how did that Texas Jam come off?
Great. Yeah.
Was that?
You know, those were the days when people had lighters.
Yeah. You know, it's funny.
Cell phones, right?
Right. It's really
funny.
Well,
you look out and hear 80,000 lighters going. You know,
that's really cool.
But again, the album was number one. It was one of the greatest shows of my life.
That's very cool. Good time to ask the next question. What are the top three, go with your knee-jerk reaction, top three musical experiences you've had?
Yeah. Well, that certainly had to be one of them. you know, doing that tour, and it was such a special thing for me. Again, having heard Boston as the opening act, in fact, in the club band I was in, we actually played a couple of Boston songs, and then I joined Sammy, and I thought that was a great thing. I said, wow, obviously getting to join Sammy Hagar, he was what a fantastic musician. And then I get to see all these other bands that I'd grown up with and loved, you know, so yeah, that was a fantastic experience there. But so all those milestones for me were very special. My first, you know, well, they say you never forget your first time. So yeah, my first gig with Sammy, my first gig with Boston. You know, so yeah, those were special ones.
That is. What was your first gig with Sammy?
Yeah, it was Sacramento Memorial Auditorium, again, where we opened for Thin Lizzy.
Right. Okay. Right. That's so cool. You mentioned about being a vegetarian. When did you become a vegetarian, and what prompted you to do that?
The first time.
You had a relapse.
The first time was about 68 or 9.
Oh, wow.
I was out on my own, just graduated from high school, was in a band, whatever then. And, you know, the old joke about what do you call a guitar player without a girlfriend?
Homeless.
So I was homeless, but my sister took me in. She said, oh, I got an extra room. You can stay here with me for a while. And she worked at a health food store, as they were called then,
right,
in the 60s, you know. And so she was a vegetarian and said, oh, this is, you know, it's going to be much more healthy for you to be a vegetarian. So I said, oh, okay, sure. I'll give that a try. So when I was staying with her, I became a vegetarian. But then as soon as I moved out, I was back to burgers and fries. But then in the 80s, again, in Sammy's band, we started hearing about animal rights issues. And the first one was, you know, veal crates.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, but they said, oh, do you know what's going on? I mean, they put veal, calves, you know, in these crates where they can't move, but it keeps them tender. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
I know. I don't want to.
I don't need to eat veal. Like, that's not a big part of my diet anyway.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, Sammy had read a book around that same time called Eat to Win, where they talked about carving up, you know, eating like pasta or whatever before the big game, you know.
Yeah.
So say, hey, we should all do that, you know. And I said, okay, great, you know. So it was, you know, cut down on the protein, but, you know, grains and vegetables and all that kind of stuff, you know, so a very balanced diet and not heavy on meat. So that worked great, you know, but people would ask, they, oh, do you feel better? I said, ah, I kind of feel the same, you know.
Yeah.
But whatever, it was, I was fine. And then when I joined Boston, both Tom and Brad were vegetarians. But again, at that point, for animal rights reasons, you know, again, that they said, you know, we don't need to. Science has come to the point where we understand what we physically need, you know,
right,
protein and amino acids and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And now we know enough that we don't have to get that from animal protein. You know, there are plenty of other sources. You know, whereas, you know, 50 years ago, you just assumed, well, you got to eat meat.
Yeah.
You know, that was the, you know, thing to do. So anyway, so I, for the tour, for 87 tour, we brought along our own chef. And I was thinking, well, that's a good time to change, you know.
Yeah.
And so he just made obviously vegetarian stuff for us. And I don't know what it was, but it tasted great.
Man, it's always good when someone's cooking for you. That's what it is.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's great.
That was it from there on up, you know. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yesterday, I just saw that Arnold Schwarzenegger has become a vegetarian, and he's, you know, funded this executive producer behind this movie coming out about eating, about becoming a vegetarian. It's got about all vegetarian bodybuilders and stuff like that. And I think I just saw a little snippet of it, but I think one of the big platforms is about, you know, the carbon footprint and stuff like that with, you know, the global warming as a critical issue. So I'm going to be interested to see that.
That's right. Yeah. Now we see that it's not a very efficient way. Again, if you're doing the carbon footprint thing, because cows need a lot of whatever they need to eat water and the whole process there. So yeah, there's that issue as well. Yeah. And the other things that have happened along the way, like free range chickens.
Yeah.
Where instead of being stuck in a little box their entire life, you know, like at least let them run around, you know, and all that. And the other thing that that happened spontaneously was the tuna fish, the dolphins in a tuna fish, right? I don't know if you remember that a while back, that people found that the tuna, you know, tuna fishermen would just have these big nets and they would catch everything. And it happened that, you know, some dolphins would get caught in there. And so the public rose up and you know, demanded that they fish some other way. And so now you see on the side of tuna fish cans, you know, dolphin free.
Yeah.
So that was some years ago. So it's things like that, again, like the veal crates that people become aware of and say, you know, I think we can do better than that.
You hope so, man. You know, we got to do something, you know, like you said, man, you got to do some positive stuff. There's a lot of negative crap going on, man. You grew up in Chicago and then San Fran. What was your childhood like? It sounds pretty good, actually.
Well, I can't complain. You know, my parents were divorced, but hey, you know, a lot of kids' parents are divorced. And when you're growing up, that's just the way it is, you know. So your dad lived in this town and you lived in the next town. But, you know, I'd see him on the weekends. And again, we lived in the suburbs of Chicago. And he had a cottage in Wisconsin, just, you know, a little cottage on a lake there. And so we'd go up there on the weekends, my sister and I. Mm. Spend time with my dad. And of course, in the summertime, we'd go swimming. He had a little sailboat. And then in the wintertime, the lake would freeze over. We'd go skating, that sort of thing. So for me, it was a great childhood. And of course, people ask, oh, you're Chicago. You're probably a Chicago blues guy, right? Well, not really. You know, I wasn't hanging out in the clubs when I was 10. You know? So I can't say I'm a real Chicago blues guy.
But let me ask you this. You lived in San Fran. I'm sure you saw some great shows at the Fillmore. What were some of the better, cooler shows you saw?
Oh, gosh. I saw Hendrix, The Doors.
Wow.
And, you know, I saw The Doors several times there because, you know, that was the place to play, you know. And, of course, The Grateful Dead. You know, Get Us an Airplane and a Moby Grape.
Moby Grape. I haven't heard that in a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And again, Quicksilver Messenger Service. And then we got to, you know, open a show for them back in 1970, I guess it was. We opened for them. So, yeah, a lot of great bands free that we opened for, again, at the Fillmore there. Like, I just couldn't believe how good they were and how sparse their music was. You know, it was just a three-piece band and a singer, right? You know, guitar, bass, drums, and Paul Rogers singing. And they had such a groove going, and I just love it. You know, and watching them live, like, man, how do they do that? You know, so yeah, some great shows.
One of my guy who this name does not come up as often as I feel it should is Yorma.
Yeah,
just a phenomenally talented guy. What was his playing like back then when you saw it?
Gosh, you know, to me, all those guys were fantastic because they were, of course, a little older than me. Mm. So any of those bands were like, wow, that's just, they're all fantastic. Again, another one I saw back in that time was Cream.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that to sit, and those were the days, again, in the film where everybody sat on the floor. There were no chairs.
Right.
You know? So you would just go in and sit on the floor. And nobody stood during the concert. You just all sat there. So, of course, me and my other guitar player buddy, we went, sat up really close, you know, and that was when Eric had the the Fool painted guitar. You know,
that the SG, yeah, that's so cool.
And I mean, like, we're right there, you know, watching Eric play. I mean, what can you say?
That is amazing. The Dead was so I saw The Dead in like 83 upstate New York, and it was like in probably a 10,000 seat arena, and there was more drugs there in one place than I'd ever seen in my life. Like, I don't think anybody was sober in the whole place. Yeah. Was it like that seeing him back? How much liberties would people take back then?
It was the concerts I went to. It's not like you smelled a lot of weed burning in the place, because those were the days when the cops were definitely watching out for the people using drugs. And, you know, we'd hear the stories about some guys end up in prison because they had, you know, they were smoking weed. They had, two stems and a seed, and they're in prison now. So things were much more secretive at shows, certainly. You know, I don't know if they came in stoned or not, but yeah, it was definitely not to be messed with.
Interesting, man. That's wild. Yeah, and to see The Doors, that must have been amazing.
Yeah. Again, they were just one of my favorite bands. You know, they were just so cool. And the way I got to see them was, I'll back up here a little bit. So, again, I've been in bands since I was in eighth grade, right? And so I'm a freshman in high school, and we had a bass player singer who was a sophomore. And I thought he was so cool because he could drive. You know, he was too young to drive, didn't have a license, right? And so he was a great guy and was really tuned into the music scene. And he got us to listen to soul music. And so this was San Francisco, so they had K-Soul, K-S-O-L, mm-hmm. and K-D-I-A. But K-Soul had Sly Stone as one of their DJs. Right?
Wow, that is cool.
They played all this, to us, cool stuff that they did not play on regular top 40 radio. And again, if you're not old enough to remember this, but when I was a teenager, AM radio was the king. That's all there was.
Me too. I'm 50. I'm 55. But yeah, so it was the same thing.
That was it. AM radio, and so they played everything, you know, from Frank Sinatra to the Beatles or whoever. And you had to, listen through this stuff to get to the songs that you like.
Yeah.
And so, again, my buddy said, check out, K-Soul. They put all this cool stuff. And so we were the blue-eyed soul guys, playing that kind of music, cover songs in our band. And their Young Rascals came to town. Mm. And he said, I'm going to go see the Young Rascals. They're playing down at the Fillmore. And he came back the next day. He said, oh, man, the Young Rascals were great. But this band opening, they were even better. They're called The Doors.
Oh, my God. How funny is that?
That was it. I mean, we went that way,
Wow. And, that's crazy, man.
Yeah, that was all of a sudden the scene shifted and we were there.
I'm working real hard to try to get Robbie on my show because I would love to have him. I mean, he's like, I saw him in concert here like, maybe 5-6 years ago with my older son. And I was like sitting in the second row and it was just so weird that I'm like, this is Robbie Krieger. This guy has really like changed the face of music as we know it, and not many people. I mean, there's certainly a handful, but not many that have done that. I mean, it's just incredible what he did, him and The Doors.
Absolutely. I really enjoy reading biographies about musicians, because where did they come from? What are their influences? What was their past? What was their influence? How'd they get to where they were? And so I've read a little bit about The Doors and how, again, they wanted to change music. They were doing something else. It worked.
Yeah, big time, man. Any low points, Gary, that you went through, a dark period you had to deal with, and how'd you get through them?
Luckily not. And I've certainly had other friends of mine that did go through some bad times, either with drugs or other personal issues or something. Been very fortunate to avoid that. My parents were Christian Scientists. Hmm. And so I grew up going to that church. And of course, one of the precepts there is no drugs. So I never got like, you know, a polio shot or whatever when I was a kid. I never had an aspirin until a couple of years ago when I had to have a root canal, you know, and I just never got into it, luckily. And as you alluded to, yeah, in the 80s, gosh, you know, people were doing crazy stuff back then. And I remember at a concert, we're playing, again, Sammy's band, and somebody's got a line of some white powder on a mirror down on the front of the stage. And he's going, here, come on, yeah, here, do some of this. As if we would, you know. It's
like, that's wild.
Crazy. You know? So there was some excess. But again, luckily, because Sammy knew he needed a guitar player that didn't do drugs, you know. And the other guys, again, I mentioned the Froom brothers.
Yeah.
Again, straight band, you know. I mean, that's because they were so into the music and wanted to, you know, make it as a career. So they were very, you know, smart guys, and we stayed away from that stuff. So, and then same thing with Tom Scholz, you know, it's like no drugs, you know? And so, I been very fortunate to avoid that.
Man, that's amazing. But how did, like, you speak to people throughout my whole life that have had all sorts of religious or philosophical beliefs, but you actually but nevertheless, in spite of these things, say, hey, man, let me just try it. You sound like you, like, it was no, it sounds like there's almost no temptation for you, even beyond the, you know, the precepts that you were expected to live by. That's pretty amazing.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I remember when, again, I was a teenager, I don't know how old I was, but I was over at a buddy's house once, and he said, again, we were teenagers. He said, hey, you want a beer? And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, give me a beer. You know, so I took a sip of it. Oh, man. A root beer? You know, I was like, wow. Just didn't appeal to me.
That's amazing, man. Good for you. And it, yeah, wow. So hindsight 2020, what is the biggest or what are the biggest advantages that came to you because of that? Or not advantages that came to you, but yeah, I guess the biggest benefits of not having done that.
Well, there you go. Being at the right place at the right time,
yeah.
The right frame of mind. Again, Sammy was looking for a guy that didn't do drugs, and so was Tom Scholz. And again, the other guys in Crossfire, that was the name of the club band.
Mm.
In fact, I'll go back and tell another story about that. So in 1974, I'm playing with this band Crossfire with the Froom Brothers.
That's the Froom Brothers. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, these other guys. And Norman Greenbaum had moved to town.
Yeah, Spirit in the Sky. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And so Spirit in the Sky, that came out in 1970.
Mm.
So he had kind of dropped out of the music scene. He had a couple of kids, and he started a goat farm in Petaluma.
Now, that's so California, man, to hear that. You know that.
Yeah, Northern California, right? So, but he wanted to get back into music, and so it's a small town, and so somehow we met him, and he said, yeah, I'd like to do some shows. I'm just going to be singer-songwriter, just play acoustic guitar, sing. And we said, great, yeah. We said, hey, Norman Greenbaum, yeah, sure. We'll be, you know, we'll open up for you. We'll do some shows together. So we did a few, and at one show, we did our set and then left the stage, and Norman comes up and he starts, you know, strumming and singing, and the audience is a little restless. Like, oh, okay. And our drummer, Steve Jones, gets up, the gear is still set up. So he gets him on stage and starts playing drums along behind Norman. Of course, Norman turns around and looks at us and we're at the side of the stage, and he calls us up, and we've seen him a few times. And so we sort of knew his songs, and we certainly knew Spirit in the Sky. And we just started playing with him. No rehearsal whatsoever. We just started playing his songs. And of course, we knew how Spirit in the Sky went, you know,
sure.
And we faked it. And of course, the audience loved that. And we started then backing him up, as Norman Greenbaum and Crossfire.
Oh, so, that's so cool. So it was like a happy accident.
Yeah. So, and he was a great guy, great songwriter. And again, very thoughtful guy. So it was a great experience for us that he could mentor us that way.
That's great, man. What a good story. Let's talk about gear just for a few minutes. That guitar that you, the Bill Foley, that's your go-to?
Absolutely. When I'm thinking, okay, where am I going to start with? That's it. You know, I pull that on and start working song ideas or whatever. Yeah, that's the one.
Do you have like a number two and number three maybe?
What would they be?
When I tour with Boston, I need a couple of special things. And so this is my number one axe with Boston. It's a PRS S2.
Man, that's a beautiful, beautiful guitar, man.
They're not expensive guitars, you know. But, of course, as you know, PRS are very well made. And so this has a couple of special things. You'll notice instead of two knobs, I've got one knob and then these switches here, right? Mm. So, and that's why I got the standard as opposed to the custom, because the standard has this larger pick guard.
Mm.
So I cut the pick guard in a couple of places, and it's only a pick guard. You know, I got a spare pick guard.
Sure.
So this is volume. This pickup is a Fernandez sustainer. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's kind of like an Ebo built into the guitar. So it'll sustain a note forever, right, with these switches. And so I use that, like, for the song Long Time with Boston. And then, you know, flip on that. You
know, that is so cool, man.
There it is, you know? And, of course, you know, it's got the whammy bar, so I need that. Whereas the Bill Foley doesn't have a whammy bar. And this has 24 frets. The Bill Foley only has 22. So, yeah.
Man, you need as many frets as you could take it. With your hands are so just like guitar perfect, man. You could probably play a 34 fret guitar without a problem. Yeah, man.
And of course, I wrap my thumb around, you know, sometimes it, you can play that low F sharp on a D chord, you know. So, anyway, but yeah, this guitar really works for me. So I've got this one with the dots, and I've got another one with birds in the inlays, and those are my guitars I use in Boston.
Very cool, man. Are those big, thick necks, or because it doesn't look like one?
It's not thick. I believe they call it their standard carve.
Hmm.
So it's not real thin, but it's not real thick either. The Bill Foley is actually a little thicker.
Very pretty. What's the best guitar and best amp you've ever owned or played?
You know,
if that's answerable.
Those are great, but I've had other guitars over the years. Again, back in the 60s, you know, I had a Strat, you know, and it was probably a 64 or something, Strat or something, you know, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
And a stack of Marshalls, you know, Plexi Marshall, because that's, you know, what you had back then, right? You know, so those were pretty good. But along the way, you know, guitar players, you know, you sell gear and try new stuff.
Sure.
And for this Alliance record, I built my own tube amp. You know, I've always loved tube amps. And I wanted a different sound than Boston. Again, with Boston, I used the Rockman stuff. It's all solid state. But for Alliance, I wanted my own sound. You know, I mean, Tom's got the Boston sound, and that's fantastic. And that sounds like Boston. You know?
Right.
But I wanted my own sound. So I built a tube amp to use for Alliance, because now that's my sound, and nobody else in the world has that, because there's only one of those amps.
So are we going to be seeing Peel amps now? Is that like, is that
you know,
your...
Somebody, you know, that I was telling this to a music store guy. I said, oh, you sell those? I said, no.
Man, well, you know the business better than anybody, so you know how to get them out there. So why not?
Well, just want to make a couple for me. That's it.
Ever sell a guitar that you regret?
All of them. Every guitar. In fact, every guitar I ever had, I wish I still had, you know, but again, you, for one reason or another, you can't keep them all along the way.
Absolutely.
When I was, working at Scholl's Research, I would go around the country and demonstrate our products to music stores and do clinics and tell guys, you know, how this stuff worked and all that sort of thing. And so one of our sales reps was taking me around, and he was from the Detroit area, you know, Herb. And he was a great old guy. And it just so happened my dad's name was Herb, and he had a son named Gary. So we kind of bonded.
Yeah, like, wow,
what a funny coincidence, yeah. You know? And so anyway, I traveled around with him to different music stores and did clinics and this and that. And so, of course, he asked me about my kids. And so I, at the time, my son, Scott, was just learning how to play guitar, or wanted to. And he was about 10 at the time. And Herb said, oh, that's interesting. Well, maybe he'll take after you. I said, maybe, I'm not going to push him into it. If he wants to, great. If not, that's fine with me too. It's a tough business, you know? And so I, again, did a little tour with him there, went back home. And out of the blue, he sent me an old Japanese guitar for my son to start on it. And I was telling her this.
God, that was awful nice.
I'm going to get him some cheap Japanese guitar because that's what I started on. You know, it's hard to play, you know, and probably sounds terrible, but that's where I started. So I'm going to get the same thing because I've got some nice guitars and I could certainly let him use that, but I want him to suffer a little bit, you know, pay some dues.
Yeah.
And so out of the blue, Herb sent me this Kent guitar, you know, made in Japan, and it was kind of a thin body and a funny little pickup on it. And it was sunburst. And my son actually started using it. Went, took some lessons, you know, not from me, went to the local music store to take some lessons. And then he saved up his money. He was mowing lawns and stuff and saved up his money and bought a Jackson. And that was cool. So we put the Kent away, you know, up on the shelf someplace. And years later, one of my crew guys said, you know, called me up out of the blue and said, you don't happen to have a Kent guitar, do you? I said, wow. As a matter of fact, I do. And he said, yeah, I'm looking for this guitar for a guy I'm working for. I said, well, I mean, this is, you know, a cheap Japanese 60s, you know, guitar. You could get a lot better guitars these days, like, you know, Fender Squire or something. Those are much better guitars. And you could buy those for $100, you know. No. He said, this guy had one when he was growing up. That's what his mom bought him. It was $69.95. He bought it, you know, she bought it for him for Christmas, you know, and whatever, 1966 or whatever it was, you know. And he said, he wants one of those in the worst way. And I said, well, and he said, yeah, we've been on eBay. We just can't find one. But you've got one, right? And I said, yeah, I'm sure. He said, is it one pickup? And I said, I don't even know. I got to go. You know, I dug it up and yeah, one pickup and sunburst. Yeah, that's it. He said, yeah, that's one. He'll buy it from you, whatever you want for it. And I said, well, they're not worth much. And he goes, he'll pay anything for it. And so I said, well, okay, I mean, it's really my son's guitar. I'll ask him. And so I asked my son, I said, gee, there's this guy that wants to buy that guitar because that was his first guitar.
Sure.
Who wants one? I said, and so my son, and so it was my son's first guitar. I said, you know, would you want to give that up to somebody, you know, who wants it? He says, yeah, I didn't even know we still had it, you know. Sure. And I said, he'll pay anything for it. What do you want? And he said, well, we didn't pay anything for it. That guy gave it to us. Let's pass it on. You know, give it back. So I called up, you know, my tech and said, yeah, this is, you know, yeah, we'll just send it to you. You know, that's fine. We got it free. You can have it free. Who is this? Who is you working for? He says, well, it's for Bruce. So it was Springsteen's first guitar.
Holy smokes.
It ended up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So Bruce's first guitar was my son's first guitar. So he could say, yeah, my first guitar is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Wow. What a story. Holy smoke.
And then when Bruce came through town, like the next year or something, we went down the show and met him and my son got to meet him. And I mean, hey, you know, Bruce. And so of course he talked about the guitar, you know, so hey, thanks for giving me a guitar. And he took a picture of it with him on it and signed it. And gave
oh, that's
it
cool. That's cool.
Yeah, he was very gracious about the whole thing. So.
That's a nice story, man. That's a really nice story, Gary.
And of course, I mentioned to Bruce, I said, you know, our moms used to work together. He says, yeah, I know, back in California.
So, oh, that's right. That's right. That is hilarious.
You know, again,
Arlene's kids done pretty well.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, what are your top three Desert Island discs just for today in no particular order? Because this could change. Any, you know, 10 minutes later, I ask you a different question.
Yeah. You know, that's hard to say. You know, all the bands that I grew up with, of course, you know, the Stones and the Beatles, from then on, you know, everybody. And again, each new band that came out was, you know, different and better. And so, yeah, I couldn't even tell you.
Fair enough, man. Best decision you ever made?
To marry my wife.
Dude, and can I say that congratulations that I know you guys, I think this is just awesome. 53 years together, 43 years of marriage. Man, that is honestly, that is the best accomplishment you've made, man. That's really cool, honestly.
Yeah, it's, again, we met in high school and, you know, we, of course, argued, broke up, got back together again, you know, wasn't all smooth sailing, but So I've known her 10 years. And by that point, it's like, no, that's it. I mean, I want to marry this girl. That's it. That, you know, that, you know. And so I give that advice to our kids too. I said, okay, you should know your spouse 10 years before you get married. Of course, they go, oh, 10 years, geez, Dad. But that's my advice, and it worked for us.
Well, congratulations again. That is a serious accomplishment. You're like just a – you've been – it's funny how – it's always interesting for me to see people. You're like totally no drama. I mean, that's how you seem. It seems like you've had like – you've intentionally avoided things to bring stress into your life, like very – not to say zen-like, because I don't know if you are or not, but you know what I'm saying, though? You've been like, you know, there are some people who everything's like pretty mellow, like consistent, and there are other people who have way big swings, and you know, you've been, it seems like, deliberate in some ways in your actions. Maybe not your intention was not to do that, but your actions have, you know what I mean? I think that's really cool.
Well, thanks. My high school reunion, my 50-year high school reunion was this last year. And so my kids were saying, gee, you going to go to the reunion? Because, of course, my wife and I both went there, right? It's our high school reunion. And she didn't particularly want to go. And I said, no, I don't think we're going to go. I said, because, you know, if I met some of the kids, you know, now they're adults, say, hey, so, Gary, what's happened in the last 50 years, right?
Yeah. Well, let's catch up.
Yeah, not much. You know, I still play guitar in a rock band. You know, I still run because I was on the track team. I still jog, you know, like 15 miles a week, and I'm still with the same girl. So not much has changed for me.
That's cool, man. No, but that's great. That's really stable and consistent. And it's a good, like, you know, as a dad, I know that's a nice thing to show your kids, because that a lot of kids don't see that.
I hope so. And I'm glad to say both my kids are into jogging and running.
You know? Yeah. That's so important to take care of yourself. That's another that's a very valuable. We've always worked out, and our kids are all pretty fit as well. I'm really happy about that, man. Most important thing your dad taught you? You mentioned some of it already.
Yes. So after high school, my dad said, okay, where do you want to go to college? And I said, well, Dad, I just want to be in a rock band. And they don't teach rock and roll in college. but they teach music. And so if you really love music, you should go to college and learn. And he drove me over to the local college to make me enroll. And I said, okay, yeah, I'll do this. But I loved it. And it wasn't because the teachers were so hip, but they were so enthusiastic about it that I just loved the classes and, you know, got good grades. And one of the kids sitting next to me turned out to be Johnny Cola, who went on to play sax and Huey Lewis in the News.
Oh, that's great, man.
So his advice was, do whatever you want to do in life, but go to school to learn how to do it. So that's my advice to young musicians as well. Is, yeah, no matter what you, what kind of music or whatever, if you want to be in music, yeah, you know, take some formal lessons or go to school or whatever. So that's the advice my dad gave.
Nice that he was so supportive of it. You know, that's really cool, I think, actually.
Absolutely. And years later, I asked him, I said, you know, Dad, you never said, gee, you should be this or that. And I said, did you ever want me to be something else? He said, well, would have been nice if you were like a corporate lawyer or something. Wow. Okay. I said, you never mentioned that at all. I said, no, I wanted you to, you know, do what you wanted to do. So
that is really, really cool. Yeah. Yeah. And that is the people often ask me, what have you learned? Or what are the number one, what are the common characteristics of the more successful musician? That's number one, supportive parents. Number one, by a long shot, number one, you know, even if there was like dysfunction in the house, or, you know, there was alcoholism, or parents had trouble, financial, whatever, they were supportive. That's the number one trait. Yeah, yeah. That's really cool. How about your mom? Most important thing she taught you?
Probably grammar. my mother is smart. She's a Mensa member.
Oh, wow.
Genius, you know. But of course, those were the days. So here's this very bright woman. She was a secretary, because those are the kind of jobs that women could have.
Yeah, man, that's terrible.
And so she would always correct my grammar. I don't always follow her advice, but I do try to speak well.
No, but you could tell you're smart. You could tell you're an intellectual person when you talk to you, that, you know, so that comes across. So whatever, you read your books like you're supposed to, clearly. You can always tell when someone's like well-read when you're speaking to them, you know?
People ask me what was like working with Tom Scholz. Like somebody said, describe Tom Scholz in four words. Oh, four words. smartest guy I know. And so, again, my mom was a Mensa, you know, member, and Tom is she's the smartest woman I know.
Right.
Tom's the smartest guy I know. Again, he went to MIT as a mechanical engineer and just taught himself electronics.
And wow.
When they put together those lists of like 100 greatest guitar players of all time, he's always on there. Mm. But he's also on the list of 100 greatest keyboard players. There's nobody else in the world that's on both those lists.
Yeah.
And then you throw in best rock songs of all time, Northern Feeling or some other Boston song comes up. Again, he designed the amps that we still use today. So he's a pretty smart guy.
Yeah, man. Hey, two more questions. Gary, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Photography has always been my hobby. And actually, my sister got me into it when I was living at her place. She had a darkroom out in her garage. And so I just always loved that. And she turned me on to Ansel Adams and landscape photographers. So that's always been my passion. And one year, way back in the 70s, I was somebody was told me that, hey, there's at the county fair, there's an exhibit for, photography, for people to enter their photos for photography. And this woman was telling me, so you should enter some of your stuff. You get some good stuff. And I said, okay. So I took a couple of my photos that were just thumbtacked to the wall and entered them. And I won first and third prize.
Holy, that's great, so, man.
I can say I'm an award-winning.
You're an award-winning photographer. Yeah. So is that your thing, landscapes? Do you like landscapes? Is that what
you shoot? Yeah.
Do you shoot with a DSLR or are you like what are you using nowadays?
Yeah, these days, DSLR, because it's so convenient. But back in the day, because of Ansel Adams and those guys, I bought a 4x5 camera. The negatives are this big.
Yeah.
And so did that. And just enjoyed doing that. Actually, some of the photos I've taken of other band members have shown up other places. Like, I took the photo of Sammy when he was in Van Halen on the cover of one of their DVDs.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And also, when I was in the band, I took another photo of him for a cover of one of our singles or something. So
that's great, man.
It's been a lot of fun.
What do you think of the new, the mirrorless cameras?
Yeah. To me, that's magic.
Yeah.
The thing that is really magic is night photography.
Yeah.
Back in the old days, I went to concerts and would sometimes take photos of friends of mine playing, in bands and all that. And no matter how bright the spotlights were, they were always dark and you had to try to use really fast film and that made it very grainy and just not great photos unless you used a flash or, again, if the lights were really bright. It was really hard to take great, photos in the dark. And certainly night scenes in cities with a lot of streetlights, didn't turn out well at all. I mean, if you look at any night scene from, earlier than the 60s or something, everything is black and a few little dots here and there. But these days with HDR, this high dynamic range.
Man, you could take a great night picture with these now.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. All this detail how is this possible? To me, that's absolute magic. Just did not exist. And again, Ansel Adams had a whole system he called the zone system. About, again, how to manipulate your processing time to get the best results from your negatives. And so, again, this goes way, way beyond what he was doing because of the technology.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I'm going to need to buy a camera soon. I'm going to probably buy a small mirrorless because I like – it's so tiny, man, and it's half the size of a DSLR.
Sure, yeah.
Hey, last question, and I really appreciate your time, and thank you. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years and how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, I guess we'll know if it's just because of age or not. But one thing I have certainly come to appreciate is the flexibility for things to change. And I certainly see that myself as a younger person that, I had some ideas like this is the way we're going to do this. And I was stubborn. As a lot of young people are, I'm sure, And so I find I'm less stubborn. And when things you know, come up that I hadn't anticipated, instead of saying, oh no, this is terrible because I wanted to go this way and now the people are pushing me this way. It's like, I try to roll with it. I said, well, maybe this is, you know, for the best. I'll try that. So that's, so yeah, I've mellowed in age. And it's funny, the same thing, Tom Scholl said the same thing to me. He said, you know, back in the day, I was really hard to work with. And I can attest to it, because some of the crew guys that worked for Boston way back in the day said, man, Tom, he's so hard. You know, we'll set up the PA and Tom will come in. You know, again, this is days we're playing a big arena. And, you know, Tom would walk around the arena to make sure this sounded good on stage. So he'd have like his guitar tech play his guitar and the rest of the band is playing. And Tom would walk around the arena to make sure everybody could hear well.
That is commitment, man.
Hand it to that guy. But if something wasn't right, you know, he'd make the crew guys, well, you know, change these, you know, turn the horns over here to this. And of course they'd complain and say, oh man, he's, well, we got to do this extra work, you know, but it's, hey, it's for the people. It's,
yeah,
you
know? And totally.
So he would say, he said, yeah, I'm much easier to get along with now than I was. I was so stubborn. And yeah, me too.
Do you think, how much of that you think is related to you just saying, hey man, you know what? This is a lot, this is way too stressful. Because I've mellowed a lot like that. And for me, it's been because, man, why stop doing stressful stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Whether you realize it or not, but yeah.
No, I realized it. I was like, yeah, this is ridiculous.
It catches up with you.
Yeah, totally, man. Gary Peel, listen, I really appreciate everything. Let me tell people where to find you. First of all, everybody check out the new Alliance record. That's when it's coming out, like soon.
It's actually been out for a couple of weeks now. Yeah.
Okay, great. So out, it's called Fire and Grace. It's a great record. It's really cool. Some great playing on there from everybody. Great writing, great musicianship. Boston, in spite of the gaps, people often say, is Boston still together? Gary?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I hope we go out next year on tour, but there's nothing official yet, but I certainly hope so. And I hope we have a new record too, but you never know.
I hope so too. And I hope you come down to Tampa, because I love to see you in person play. And DecemberPeople.com, that's the fun band that Gary and Rob do, and for Christmas, for good causes, and they put on some great, you know, just a couple of guys getting together having a good time, man. So go support them and the causes. And that's about it. And anything else I forgot? Anything else I missed?
Man, you have covered it all, Greg.
Gary, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with the new Alliance album. I hope you guys come out and do some dates, and look forward to seeing you in Boston again, man.
I hope so. I would love to do some festivals with Alliance. Where
that would be fun
shows.
Cool.
Yeah, where, you know, they're 10, 20 bands on a show over a couple of days, and the audience comes knowing they're going to see bands they've never seen before. So they may recognize us from our other groups, but I'd love to do some festivals.
So any promoters listening, now's your chance. Contact Gary Peel from Boston Alliance and Sammy Hagar. Thanks, brother. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Craig.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Subscribe to the podcast and to the YouTube channel. Thanks very much to Gary Peel. Please check out the new Alliance record, Fire and Grace. It's an excellent record, and you're going to enjoy it. Go see Boston when they're on tour. Check out DecemberPeople.com and wait for the Alliance show if it comes. And if you're a promoter, book Alliance on your next festival. Make sure you go to EveryoneLovesGuitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at EveryoneLovesGuitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.